From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Coming up, reported Klansman James Ford Seal was sentenced today for the 1964 abduction and killing of two black teens in southwest Mississippi. We're going to talk about that and more on our reporters' roundtable. But first, Republican Senator from Virginia John Warner had strong words for the president.
We simply cannot, as a nation, stand and put our troops at continuous risk of loss of life and limb without beginning to take some decisive action which will get everybody's attention.
Yesterday, Warner said about 5,000 troops serving in Iraq should be brought home around Christmas. Warner says this would send a bold message to the Iraqi leadership that time is running out and that the U.S. commitment to stabilize the region is not open-ended. For more, we've got Kevin Merida, associate editor of The Washington Post. He's also editor of the book Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Also with us is Sean Gonzalez. He's assistant news editor for the Cape Cod Times and a syndicated columnist, and broadcaster reporter Mara Schiavo-Campo. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So Senator Warner is the latest in a growing number of Republicans who were just speaking out against the war or at least abandoning the president's stay-the-course approach. What does this say, Mara, about the current leadership and how it relates to Iraq?
Well, Senator Warner said that he came to the conclusion that he did after visiting Iraq. And so he saw the situation on the ground as it was in order to make his assessment. The fact is that there is strong support for his assessment of the government. Yesterday, the National Intelligence Report was released, and it had a very bleak view of the government's performance, the Iraqi government's performance now and in the future. They found that the government is not governing very well now, that it could potentially govern worse in the next 6 months to a year. They're not doing much to repair sectarian rifts. And so seeing that reality on the ground seems to be what drove Warner to his conclusion. The view, even in today's New York Times, there was an editorial that we cannot continue to lose American lives given the state of the government and the bleak future of the government.
Mara, let me just break in and ask you about your own experiences. You've been to the Middle East. And do people there, how do they perceive the U.S. involvement in this war?
Well, I have been to the Middle East several times all over the region, and it's no surprise that people do not have a favorable view of the United States and of their involvement in the war in Iraq. And one thing that actually surprised me, which I didn't see as a related issue until I traveled to the Middle East, is that when you go and you try to speak to people about the war in Iraq, they inevitably turn it into an issue of the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. That's what people really want to talk about. And it seems that that's really a source of frustration towards the United States. So people, they see it in a much wider context. They see the United States foreign policy in a much wider context than I think tends to be seen here.
Sean, do you think that the security concerns for the U.S. military will be increased if there's a fixed timetable, or how are people going about that discussion?
Well, of course, I mean, the standard argument you hear is that if we withdrew, not only are we sort of turning back on a moral obligation to, you know, if we broke it, we fix it, and these kind of analogies, but then, you know, you hear people talk about Neville Chamberlain and appeasement and how it emboldened the enemies, but you know, I think if people look a bit closer, I think they'll find the analogy to Neville Chamberlain and appeasement to be a false one, particularly because, you know, during World War II, Neville Chamberlain and England's, you know, famous appeasement of Hitler was really born out of military weakness. And if you talk to a lot of military historians and scholars, they'll tell you that if you're going to conciliate, you conciliate softly but carry a big stick. In other words, there's a huge difference between recognizing mistakes and pulling back when you're a strong nation militarily, particularly as we are, and when you're weak. And people see it as, well, you're weak and you're pulling back, and so we're going to take advantage of that. I don't think that's the case with with the United States.
Kevin, next month, General David Petraeus plans on making an announcement about the state of affairs in Iraq. There's been some criticism, first of all, that the Bush administration has its hands too deep in that report for political reasons. But how is this play by some Republicans to really change the debate going to affect how that report hits the ground?
Well, I think that there's a lot of pressure on Republicans across the spectrum, and a lot of people have their eye on 2008 too, and how that plays. They know that this administration is pretty much, you know, done. You see, even the top political hands, Karl Rove leaving. So the pressure is on Republicans across the board, and I think that Warner really kind of represents, you know, maybe a turn in that, in the sense that, you know, for him to call for an actual timetable, I believe you'll see a lot of other people pick up on that, because he's someone who has sway with moderate Republicans and someone who's respected across the aisle, and someone who, you know, chaired the Armed Services Committee and is considered really an expert in this field. So I think that this heightens the and I think when Petraeus's report hits, you will see a lot of people across in both parties really putting the pressure on Bush even more.
Kevin, let me stay with you. James Ford Seal was sentenced today for the 1964 murders of two black teens in southwest Mississippi. Now, he was sentenced to three life terms. Was justice served?
Well, I think that what we have been seeing in the last several years and going back is you've seen a really active interest in trying to prosecute some of these civil rights and hate crimes in the South. Prosecutors have been very aggressive about that. We've seen witnesses who, in many cases, have, in some of these cases, you know, wouldn't testify back then, coming forward. And I think there's also a sense in these communities, from a political standpoint, that this is what is required to have healing in these communities. You've seen a lot of prosecutions that have been more aggressive than they have been in the past. And so I think that many people would say justice was served.
Sean, is this a case of good journalism? And what I mean by that is that reporters, including Jerry Mitchell of the Jackson, Mississippi Clarion Ledger, really started investigating these cases after decades had passed. Should journalists be applauded in this case?
Well, I mean, I think so. I mean, you don't want to, you know, it's a little easy for us to pat our own backs or in a sense, but I do think it does underscore the importance of journalists being vigilant, which we could have used a lot more of in the run-up to the war to Iraq. However, you know, there are some really good journalists out there who really care about the truth, and I think it's important regardless of, you know, there's many instances where sometimes people think if you even bring up racial issues that somehow you're being a bigot or a reverse racist. But, you know, I do think it speaks to the importance of when journalists are at their best, the type of effect, positive effect they can have, you know, in communities.
I'm going to move on, Mara, to the case of Michael Vick. Just more and more and more discussion. Now, the Atlanta chapter of the NAACP said on Wednesday that the Falcons quarterback should not be banned from playing in the NFL. Is this really a civil rights issue? I mean, the national headquarters spoke out against animal cruelty.
Yeah, that's a great question. No, it's not a civil rights issue. Now, I respected the NAACP's national office when they came out a few weeks ago and said that we need to reserve judgment because Michael Vick had not been convicted of anything. And at that point, I thought that was the right thing to do, because the presumption of innocence is not something that has always been extended to black men. But now he is saying that in a few days he is going to plead guilty to these awful, despicable crimes. And so I don't understand why anyone would stand up at this time, before he's even served his punishment, and say, you know, try to support his actions. And I have a quote here from the president of the Atlanta chapter of the NAACP that said, "It's regrettable that Michael Vick had to settle for a plea bargain. All of us had hoped for a more favorable outcome." And I'm really wondering, what outcome is that they were hoping for? That because he's a great football player, he can commit crimes and not be held accountable for them?
And Kevin, you know, you did some reporting on dogfighting. What did you see? How does that influence how you look at the case?
Well, there's an entire underground, underworld of dogfighting that's very secretive. And in the level that Michael Vick is talking about, that's involved, allegedly involved in, I guess he's going to plead guilty to that, is really a secretive world where they have dog conventions. I've seen dog fights. I've been with the dog fighters during some of my investigative reporting earlier in the career. And it's very brutal. In their culture, they think that it's something that is no different than cockfighting, and they think it's no different than boxing. And those are the kind of explanations that you hear. But clearly, the kinds of offenses that are in the indictment, in the Vic indictment of electrocuting dogs who are no longer useful to them is really something that is pretty heinous. So, you
Let
know,
me,
I,
sorry,
no,
go
jump
ahead.
In. No, I just think that, you know, going back to what was said earlier, that, you know, he's admitted to this, and it's kind of hard. I think there's a reflexive tendency to want to be protective sometimes of African-American public figures. We've seen that in many other cases, and I think that's what's happened with Vic, but this is really a serious crime.
Sean, very quick hit. There was a case recently where two wealthy New Jersey residents had 23 decomposing cats and dogs in one home. Should this case be judged as animal cruelty the same way that Vic is?
Well, I mean, clearly, because of who Vic is, it sort of has more cachet and it sort of attracts more attention. But I do think, you know, behind all of this, and this is part of that reflexive action, is in this country, you know, as Stanley Crouch has noted before, that when blacks commit crimes, it's usually considered to be a comment on race. But when you have white brothers and sisters involved, it's often considered to, at best, to be a comment on society, but usually just those individuals. I mean, in cases like this, people don't walk around and start talking about, you know, white thug culture or what's wrong with suburban white America. But those are often the kind of discussions that happen when a case like Vic, although like the previous, you know, guests have mentioned, I think this is different, and I don't think this is a civil rights issue. But I, you know, and I think it's bigger because it's Vic. But there is always that element that the conversation, the reaction is generally one where soon we're talking about black pathology in one instance, and in the other case we're just talking about the, you know, oh my God, this is so shocking.
Well, Sean, we have to let all of you go. Thank you so much. Sean Gonzalez, assistant news editor for the Cape Cod Times, broadcaster reporter Maria Schiavo-Campo, recently named Emerging Journalist of the Year by the National Association for Black Journalists from our NPR Bureau in New York, and associate editor of the Washington Post, Kevin Merida, who also wrote Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. He joined us from the Washington Post studios. And just ahead, tech expert Mario Armstrong and the lady soul, Miss Aretha Franklin.